This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. Spanish elections this past weekend really shook up that country politically. This seems to be happening more and more in Europe. It was just in France recently, but this election points to another flare-up of a long-standing economic crisis that Europe has been trying to put off for several years now, and it looks like this crisis is coming to a head. We're going to talk about this with trumpet writer Richard Palmer. He's going to bring us up to speed with the euro crisis and how 2016 could be the year that Europe has to deal with this decisively. Turkey and Russia are at odds with one another thanks to the Turks shooting down a Russian plane. The situation is escalating with Russia slapping economic sanctions on Turkey, and both nations have quite a few levers to use against one another. It's an interesting battle shaping up here with two strong-willed dictators facing off and neither really willing to lose face over this. And it's a battle that has some significant geopolitical implications for a lot of countries. We're going to talk with trumpet writer Robert Morley about this situation and how it might play out. Each year around this time, there are images everywhere of baby Jesus in a manger. And then the rest of the year, of course, you have popular image of Jesus as a slender man with light skin, light blue eyes, long flowing hair, often hanging on a cross. Forensic scientists in Britain have challenged that popular depiction. They've looked at evidence from anthropology and archaeology, from the culture of that region in Jesus Christ's time, evidence from the Bible, and they say Jesus didn't look anything like the images that you're used to seeing. Finally, we're going to finish the program by talking about something to keep in mind when you face failure in life. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. Europe is facing a lot of problems today. We've had our focus on the refugee crisis. There have been major terrorist attacks. Maybe we've taken our eyes off another ongoing crisis. That is the crisis in Europe's economy. There are several countries in the Eurozone that are in serious financial trouble. Europe has repeatedly kicked the can down the road in dealing with these crises, but with each delay, the crisis grows more serious. Well, this past weekend, Spain held elections, and it was a doozy of a result. It flipped the politics of this nation on its head. Traditional parties got hammered. Fringe parties got unprecedented support, and this is a pattern that we've seen unfold earlier in other European countries. It's an outgrowth of the economic problems facing these nations. I have trumpet writer Richard Palmer here to explain this to us and to talk about how what's happening here could have serious ramifications for Europe, both economically and politically going forward. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon.
Well, first, let's just talk about the details of this election in Spain. What happened there?
Right. Well, it was a political earthquake. You had the two parties that have dominated Spanish politics since they came out of a dictatorship, basically, had combined pretty much their worst result ever. And then you had two new political parties that were only founded last year in 2014, come from basically nowhere to become major forces in Spanish politics. One of these parties, Podemos, they are a left-wing party. They came from being founded last year to win 20% of the vote. The other party, called Ciudadanos, they are probably best described as kind of a libertarian party. They want to legalize things like prostitution and marijuana. At the same time, they're fairly conservative on the economy, so they want low taxes, little borrowing, little regulation. They came from nowhere to have 13% of the vote. So you had this big upset in the electoral system. But then more than that, the way the results have kind of fallen, there's no obvious coalition in Spain either. So you've got these new parties, and I think there's a lot of people believe that these new parties have nothing to gain from working with the old parties that they kind of denounce as corrupt. So they may not even want to work with them full stop, But even if they did, there's no obvious majority. So if you had the Ciudadanos ally with the Popular Party, who are the conservatives, they wouldn't have enough to form a majority. Podemos, if they allied with the Socialist Party, the main left-wing party, they wouldn't have enough to form a coalition government. So not only have you had this big upset, but then they're also stuck in this political paralysis, and it looks like it will take quite a while to figure out a coalition. Even once it's figured out, it's probably going to be very weak. It may not even be a coalition. It may just be a minority government. So it's a milestone result, really.
And give us an idea of what the Spanish voters were reacting to. What was it that caused these political fringe parties and these brand new parties coming out of nowhere to receive this level of support, really a reaction against the establishment politics?
Right. So there are some local considerations. So, for example, Rajoy, the current prime minister, was embroiled in quite a lot of corruption scandals, and there were some sleazy things, or at least reports of some sleazy things, money in brown envelopes, those kind of allegations around his party. So there was this widespread perception that the traditional parties are corrupt, and therefore we should turn to these newer parties. However, also a very big part of this rise was an anti-austerity movement. Just like you saw with Syriza in Greece and the rise of Alexis Tsipras, there was a backlash against this, what's seen as a rule from Germany. So, for example, this is from the leader of Podemos, that brand new left-wing party. He said, "Our message to Europe is clear. Spain will never again be the periphery of Germany. We will restore the meaning of sovereignty." So they saw a lot of Southern Europe Germany basically controlling all of Europe and controlling the Europe economy, handing down diktats to these different nations on how they should run their economy.
Yeah, let's just back up and just bring listeners up to speed who haven't followed this story. These countries, they're deeply indebted, and basically Germany, the strongest economy within Europe, they're saying that if you want to be a part of the Eurozone, if you want to be a part of the Euro, then you're going to have to manage your economic affairs very differently.
Right. There's a set of rules that everybody in the Euro has to adhere to, and what it means basically for Southern Europe. They're all in a lot of debt, and a lot of that debt, by the way, is a response to them being in the Euro. But as a consequence of joining the Euro, the governments were able to borrow much more money than they'd been able to do traditionally. They borrowed tons. They're in a lot of debt, and then the European rules mean that they're not allowed to borrow any more money until they've paid off most of that debt. And so for some people, there's a left-wing desire to borrow and spend more, kind of how you see in the Democratic Party in the United States. Europe and Germany gets in the way of that, and that upsets them. They don't like cuts. They don't like austerity. And for other people, it's simply a matter of sovereignty. They may well agree that the country is in too much debt. They may well believe that the country doesn't need or needs to borrow less or needs to start saving. But they do not like being told to do that by Germany.
And essentially, this push and pull that you have, say, in the interests of each of these nations, is exactly the kind of problem that was baked into the Euro project from the very beginning. The point that we've made time and time again, that it was set up to fail in order to enable Germany to amass more political power once you had exactly these kinds of problems result from trying to cram all of these economies into a single set of rules.
Exactly. And I think some of those people would not have necessarily, who designed the Euro, I think a good chunk of them probably didn't anticipate it giving Germany more power. Because remember, when the Euro was designed, everyone was still talking about Franco-Germany and this Franco-German center for the Europe of Europe. So I think there were quite a few that were probably a little short-sighted. Jean Monnet, for example, we talk about quite a bit, who, as you can tell from the name, was French. I think they anticipated a strong centralization of power, but not all of them realized that it would have inevitably be Germany as the Europe's strongest economy in the driving seat. Now, obviously, I think a lot of the Germans did see that, but to a certain extent, some people like Jean Monnet were almost willing, ended up being willing participants in their own country's subjugation to Germany.
So the reaction that you're getting here, you quoted the these left-wing politicians in Spain basically saying, we are not going to be beholden to Germany in this way. There's definitely a recognition. Certainly you saw that within Greece. You saw that within Portugal, that Germany is in the driver's seat, and a deep level of discomfort in these nations to having that kind of, basically giving Germany that kind of power. So we're seeing this pushback in Spain against that. So what does that mean then as we look forward to what happens politically within Spain and Europe more broadly?
I think there is the potential for a serious pushback against Germany now. The other country I'd just like to bring in here as well is Italy, because Italy, their Prime Minister, Matteo Renzi, he just came out and gave a very strong anti-German speech in the wake of the Spanish referendum. And from Italy's point of view, Germany is really being a jerk right now. They, you've got this economic subjugation that we've talked about. Italy has a huge banking crisis looming. They have 20% of all their outstanding loans are non-performing, so they're not getting paid back. So there's a few other things going on there that's building to a major banking crisis there. Germany is absolutely refusing to help. Then you look at the immigration crisis, and a lot of those nations on the edge of Europe blame Germany and blame Chancellor Angela Merkel for pulling more immigrants to Germany through her statements about, you know, there's no limit to the number of immigrants that we can accept, etc. So they're annoyed with Germany about that. Then just this past week, you had another contention over Russia. Italy asked to delay a vote on whether to continue sanctions on Russia. Germany said, no, we're not going to delay that vote. It was held as normal. Europe voted to continue to have sanctions on Russia. Meanwhile, Germany is moving forward with their own plan, their own deal with Russia to get natural gas and build another natural gas pipeline under the Baltics directly from Russia to Germany. So Italy sees Germany telling Italy, no, you can't have any deals with Russia. And meanwhile, the Germans are then turning around and working on their own deal with Russia that they've written just so that it gets around the small print of the sanctions deal. So Italy is getting seriously annoyed with Germany right now. So you're getting the whole of Southern Europe getting boiling over to the point now that they could come out in all-out revolt against Germany. Well, to get a sense of what could happen with that, if that does happen, I don't think it's guaranteed that they would do that. In the past, Germany's been pretty good at dividing and ruling here. But look at what happened this summer, where Greece boiled over in open revolt against Germany. Germany came back with the most forceful, the most ferocious put down, just cowering Greece into submission that we had yet seen in the Euro crisis. Their biggest ever display of strength. And so if you have Southern Europe try the same thing, what you're going to do is it's just going to force Germany to come back with that even stronger response. So what we see with the banking crisis in Italy, with these political crises in Southern Europe, is things are just building to a point where it's going to become impossible to keep kicking the can down the road. And Germany is going to be forced to confront this crisis, certainly, and maybe even Southern Europe as well, head on to take care of this.
Yeah, it's not difficult to sympathize with these countries that are deeply concerned and very uncomfortable with the kind of power that Germany is amassing. And at the same time, it's not difficult to sympathize with the German position. In a sense, these countries that are basically spending far more than they should, that are so hooked on social programs and basically living the good life when they don't have the money to do it, and nations like Germany who are having to bail them out and bail them out and bail them out, and German taxpayers who are having to foot the bill for, you know, citizens in other countries to be able to keep receiving their pensions and so on. It really is reaching ahead here, isn't it? Like, there's a point where there has to be dramatic change. And so you're suggesting this coming year, 2016, might be the year that Europe has to stop kicking the can down the road and deal with this once and for all. What might an actual solution look like?
Well, first of all, they have proved pretty amazingly good at kicking the can down the road. So although I find it hard to see how they could do that for much longer, there is still that potential. But there's a whole number of different ways that it's going to play out. And we don't know all the specifics. But ultimately, when we've been forecasting this crisis and analyzing this crisis, we've been following the blueprint that just comes straight from what Herbert W. Armstrong wrote about how Europe would unite. And in our booklet, he was right. There are all these quotes from him that are just tremendously prescient, talking about how there would be this financial crisis and how it would force Europe together. And that's what we followed in forecasting this crisis so far. And one thing that we do know from what he forecast is that the Catholic Church is going to have some kind of a role as well in the solution. So maybe there will be this kind of subjugation, this kind of straight-up conflict, Germany wins, or perhaps though it will kind of build to a head and you'll have the Catholic Church step in as a mediatory role. And Mr. Armstrong said a few different times, the only way Europe is going to be able to effectively unite is through what he called the good offices, I think he put in quotes, of the Vatican. And so somehow they're going to have to come in there, I think, to be the glue and to stop this from being Northern Europe and Southern Europe just at their throats the whole time. Add to that the pressure, the outside pressures that are on Europe, things like Russia, the growing instability in the Middle East, radical Islam and terrorism. This all plays in, and that's going to put some pressure on Europe to not just disintegrate into infighting, but to come to some kind of agreement. So there will be some kind of agreement moving forward. What we don't know yet, I think, is whether it will be some kind of outright defeat of Southern Europe by Northern Europe, and then they'll get the Vatican involved, or whether it would be much more conciliatory and maybe driven by fear of the crises that's going on outside, and they come to some more diplomatic kind of a solution.
Yeah, certainly a few different scenarios, the way that this could end up playing out, definitely something we need to continue to watch. I'm glad you are bringing the Euro crisis back to our attention. We're talking to trumpet writer Richard Palmer. He's working on an article, Is the Euro Crisis Building to a Climax? You can watch for that in the coming days online at thetrumpet.com. Thanks again, Richard.
Great to be here.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Relations between Turkey and Russia are strained, to say the least. A month ago, Turkish combat aircraft shot down a Russian bomber aircraft, really unnecessary provocation by Turkey of Russia. Jordan Friedman says the Turks have clearly decided that Russia, not the Islamic State, is the primary enemy. Vladimir Putin is no pushover. He slapped $9 billion in economic sanctions against Turkey. These two countries really have quite a lot of levers that they can use against each other. I have trumpet writer Robert Morley here to talk about the latest developments here. Hello, Robert.
Good to be here.
What is Turkey doing here? Did they get in over their heads?
Well, that's a great question. When you look at Vladimir Putin, you look at Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan, these are both very, very strong individuals, personality-wise. There's a lot of similarities between these two men. Putin talks a lot about reviving the Russian Empire, how the collapse of the Soviet Union was the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. Erdogan similarly talks about a lot of his rhetoric revolves around reviving the Ottoman Empire. He's basically taken Turkey away from its secular roots and towards much more of an Islamic stance. So you see two individuals here that are somewhat working at odds, very imperialistic in their actions, both working hard to increase the relative power of their states. So just getting back to your question, has Turkey bitten off a little bit more than it's than it can chew? Well, that's a good question, and a lot of analysts are just looking at how things are going and wondering, and that's something we may see. We'll just have to wait and see going forward.
This just kind of blew up out of nowhere, it seems like. I don't think anybody was really anticipating these two countries going at it, and essentially this little sliver of Turkey that Russia flew over, this is the type of thing that nations do all the time. This tiny sliver, it takes 17 seconds for a Russian plane to fly over. And there was one day, the Turks, they said, don't do that, stop doing that. And then one day, they were right there at the trigger, ready for that Russian plane to fly over, and bam.
Okay, yeah, absolutely right. But here's the thing. There's a couple of elements at play here. Turkey had been warning Russia at least 20 times. This is our airspace. Whether or not it's a small violation of it or not, that's Turkey's right to protect their airspace. But I think the bigger thing that's going on here is just the fact that what Russia was doing with those airstrikes, they were hitting ISIS positions, they were hitting Syrian free rebel positions, and both of those organizations that Russia was hitting were working against Bashar Assad's Assyria. They're fighting against Assad. So Russia's actions were working to prop up Assad, and that's something that Turkey isn't exactly happy about. They would love for Assad to be pushed from power. They want Assad a push from power. That's Turkey's position. They would like Assad removed and to have some other form of government ruling, one much more receptive to Turkey's, I think, positions in power. So they don't want to be allowing Russia to use airspace to be working against their goals.
Well, it was really a pretense. If they're wanting to pick a fight with Russia, I mean, I suppose they could have used anything to do this, but this is the type of thing. Turkey itself, they violate airspace of other nations all the time.
They were in Iraq just last week against the wishes of the Iraqi government. Yeah, absolutely.
It is interesting. I mean, you talk about these two guys, Erdogan and Putin, kind of being cut from the same cloth, but we're looking at Putin kind of on a he's in a different stratosphere in terms of the kind of power that he has globally and the way that he's managed to use the levers of power that he controls in Russia, major energy powerhouse, major nuclear powerhouse versus Turkey.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about it. I think you were mentioning earlier that Daniel Pipes had mentioned that the Turks maybe had overstepped here, overplayed their hand a little bit. And I think the Turks, when they just look at the numbers, they could be deceived into thinking that they're a little more powerful than perhaps they are. Their hand is a little stronger than what it is. If you look at the numbers, their economy, the Turkish economy is as big as Russia's today. That's how far Turkey has grown in the last decade, and Russia has come down. And now with falling oil prices, Russia's economy might be smaller than the Turkish economy. So from the economic perspective, the Turks are probably feeling a little bit of their power. They're feeling confident in that respect. In terms of militaries, they're both advanced militaries, both have Western-style techniques and technology. Russia probably has the edge, but Turkey has access to NATO. So Russia's a nuclear power, yes, but Turkey is home to nuclear weapons via NATO as well. So the Turks are looking at that. And then the Turks are probably also looking at what Russia has done in Ukraine to alienate the West, to alienate the Europeans. And Turkey's been working with Germany and other nations to help stop this refugee problem. And I think Turkey feels like it has Europe on its side in some of these issues. And plus, with oil prices falling, Turkey probably thinks, okay, I need to act now. This is, if we are going to confront Russia, this is the time to do it. But all that being said, as you pointed out, Russia is, I mean, it has just shown itself over the last few years to be a power to be reckoned with. I mean, it has defied the world, the Western world in Ukraine. It did it in Georgia. And it's turned those things to successes, whereas the Western world, when you look across the Middle East, it's been defeat after defeat after defeat, whether it's in Iraq or the way Afghanistan's going today or in Libya and now in Syria. So as you said, Putin is the man to watch.
Well, how much is Turkey relying on NATO, and you just wonder if that's really a safe gamble. NATO, you know, how much does, say, the United States want to get involved in this? They haven't shown any real determination to stand up to Russia. And to this point, even European nations, as concerned as they may be about what Russia has been doing, you know, it's been mostly talk, not a lot of action. So really, this is the first time that you've had an outside nation say, hey, wait a minute, Russia, you know, we don't like what you're doing. We're going to shoot down one of your planes. I mean, no other NATO nation has been willing to do anything like that.
Yeah. Great point. Everything we see in Syria today is being driven by the withdrawal of the United States from the Middle East. I mean, this is a rebalancing of power within the Middle East that's going on. This is all about determining who are the new directors within the Middle East. The king of the region is being determined. Who is going to geopolitically have the largest influence, where that influence is going to begin and end. And those lines are being redrawn. And that's what's going on in Syria today. And I think you mentioned Turkey also, you know, it being the first one to stand up to Russia. One thing we haven't mentioned is that Turkey does hold a very powerful card with Russia. It controls the Dardanelles and the Bosphorus. And that is, you know, what analysts call the Syria Express for Russia. That is Russia's only route from its Black Sea bases into Syria, where it has that naval base in Tartus. And that is a very important base for Russia. And that's Russia's only outlet to warm waters. Russia's other naval bases all get frozen over in the wintertime. So Turkey knows that that's a very powerful weapon in its hand too. And that too is probably giving it a little bit of confidence with Russia.
You mentioned just these two personalities and how much they rely on prestige. They rely on reputation. Daniel Pipe says the Russian and Turkish leaders' similar personalities suggests that neither of them will compromise or retreat, implying that this confrontation will have lasting repercussions. It's interesting because you know you're mentioning all of these factors that would be working against Vladimir Putin. He's got to be looking at this and weighing his options and trying to figure out, well, how do I extricate myself from this without losing face or without having my reputation damaged, like I'm getting beaten up by this Turkish thug. Certainly something that he's got to be concerned about, in addition to some of these strategic concerns that you're talking about, just his you know, cult of personality, preserving that.
Yeah, absolutely. And Putin does have some pretty big bargaining chips as well. He holds probably the fate of Assad in his hands. And for the West, that's a pretty big issue. Western leaders have come down very strongly. They want Assad gone. They want him removed. And if that happens, it'll be probably by Putin's doing, if Putin allows that to happen. Now, Putin wants to make sure he keeps that naval base in Tarsus. I don't think that he has any special affinity or love specifically for Bashar Assad. But he wants to make sure that whatever happens in Syria, Russia doesn't lose that base. He may want to even keep the Air Force base that he's built there now. He's flying sorties from. So there's some elements there that, you know, when he trades that card, Bashar Assad, if he trades that card, what will he get in return for that? And I think there is a mechanism in place where he will be able to save face and even come out perhaps looking like the man who brought peace to Syria. So I think that in terms of Putin being able to save face there, I think there are a lot of opportunities. I think when deals get struck, and I think they will, because I don't think either of these nations wants to go to war with each other. They don't want this turning into a hot war, which would be terribly destructive for both nations. And I think there will be ways for both of those leaders to save face in Syria.
One other element before we finish, just the fact that Turkey is essentially reaching out to Israel as somewhat of a lifeline. Here they are. They've provoked this this tussle with Vladimir Putin. Very, very reliant on Russian energy, and now saying, well, Israel, how about if we strike an energy deal to make ourselves less reliant on Russia, to have another ally. And this is the Turkish-Israel alliance. This is obviously something that has been a linchpin for stability in the Middle East for a long time, but has fractured in recent years under Erdogan, who's really anti-Israel, anti-Semitic in a lot of ways. It's an interesting aspect to what's going on here. You know, it's not hard to see what Turkey may gain from it, but Israel, not as easy to see how this is really in their long-term interests.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you brought that up. Turkey relies on Russia 55% of its natural gas, and I think this has led some commentators, as you know, see Turkey's move to reach out to Israel as a sign of weakness. Like maybe it had overplayed its hands with Russia. Now we're scrambling. We need to find where we're going to be able to pick up this natural gas, what we need to, you know, keep the lights on back home. But it is very interesting from Israel's perspective what exactly they would gain from this. Obviously, there's some economic things that they would gain. Right now, they're not selling the gas to anyone. They basically have been held up by Turkish concerns over the issue. This gas field, the Goliath gas field, Leviathan gas field being located in the Mediterranean off the coast of Israel. A lot of those waters contested by Cyprus and other countries that have claims to the area. So, yeah, there is an economic side to it for Israel, but it doesn't really gain a lot more from it that I can tell from that.
It certainly couldn't expect that, you know, it's going to have any real ally of any you know, that it can trust as it faces pressures from a lot of different directions.
Yeah, and
in Erdogan's Turkey.
Right, right. And I don't think Benjamin Netanyahu would be, you know, deceived by the Turks in any way. I think he's seen the direction the relationship between Turkey and Israel has gone ever since the flotilla events that happened a few years ago. So he's very aware of those things, and I don't think that it would be necessarily, you know, putting Israel in danger in that effect, in that respect. But I think it does just show how volatile alliances change in the Middle East, how things, you know, another event happens and everything gets completely shifted around again. And now here's Erdogan, who was so vocal against Israel just a few years ago, even, you know, taking Israel to the United Nations and causing all kinds of problems for Israel. And here he is now turning to Israel, you know, just a year later, or a couple of years later, or whatever it is, asking for their help in this issue.
Yeah, it definitely shows you how complex this whole theater is. How many different there are so many countries, major big playing countries involved in what's happening in Syria. I guess in a lot of ways that's kind of the linchpin, as we've talked about in recent programs, to the whole thing, and all of these countries that have interests at stake there, and they're trying to jockey for position. Who comes out on top? We have a big picture overview, thanks to Bible prophecy, but the details and how to connect the dots to get there, boy, it is fascinating to watch it unfold.
It sure is. It'd be fascinating to see a graphic just showing every nation and which nation is fighting who. They're all fighting ISIS, and yet many of those nations fighting ISIS are fighting each other and working against each other, and it is just a microcosm of the Middle East as a whole.
Did you just volunteer to put an infographic together for a future Trumpet magazine? I really appreciate that, Robert. We're talking to Trumpet writer Robert Morley. He has an article up on thetrumpet.com. Will Turkey fight Russia in Syria? You can look that up online, thetrumpet.com. Thanks for your time, Robert.
More than welcome.
And we'll keep our eyes on this amazing situation as it continues to develop.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Coming up on Christmas, there are images everywhere of a little baby in a manger. That is one popular depiction of Jesus Christ. The other is the one that you see basically the rest of the year, especially around Easter, and that is a skinny, long-haired man hanging on a cross. Whenever he's portrayed in movies, that's the version you get, a guy who's a little bit taller than everyone else, light skin, light blue eyes, long flowing hair. Well, there's a story that's gone around for some years from Popular Mechanics saying that modern science shows that these images that you're used to seeing are dead wrong. I remember when this story first came out about 13 years ago, it's resurfaced again and made the rounds on the internet. I have trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques here to talk about this. Hello, Jeremiah.
Hello.
So first of all, what are these scientists saying that Jesus Christ actually looked like?
Well, the main thing that they're saying is what he didn't look like. And that's exactly what you mentioned there at the beginning, the images that we traditionally see of that thin, pale-skinned, very handsome man with the long flowing locks of light brown hair. You know, those images are ubiquitous in the world of Christianity. But those images are based almost entirely on paintings by artists like Leonardo da Vinci, who lived hundreds of years after Christ and who actually had very little insight into his actual appearance. They were basing their paintings on some earlier works of art in some cases, but even those earliest works of art were created hundreds of years, even in the best case scenario, after Christ lived. So this team of forensic scientists say that the actual Christ would have looked quite different from that. He would have had a fairly tanned complexion and short hair, possibly curly hair and a matching beard, just because he would have looked exactly like the typical Semite of that time in that area. And this team does use Bible passages to inform. They relied on the Bible in many cases to inform their study. So what they came up with is just something that's in stark contrast to that typical blonde, blue-eyed, tall, sort of, very, very handsome traditional depiction. And they also chimed in on his height, which would have been not towering above the other men, but probably right around the same height, which at that time was 5'1". That would have been the average height of a man at the time.
So it is interesting to just think about this this image that we tend to associate with Jesus Christ. This is a Renaissance era image. This is artists who were basically trying to portray the Son of God in a crowd of people. Obviously, a lot of times they're putting a halo around his head. They're differentiating him. His height, I'm sure that works aesthetically. It makes for a good composition of a painting, but it's really gotten us off track in terms of what he actually looked like.
Yeah, it really has. It conforms to, in many cases, what the standards of beauty were at the time those paintings were created. But we know that fashion changes drastically, even from decade to decade, and much more so from century to century. So in some ways, we're clinging to these ideals that were upheld in the 14 and 1500s of a standard of beauty that the Bible actually says would not have been embodied in the actual Jesus Christ. So there's a lot wrong with those traditional depictions of Christ.
So I'd like to get into some of those Bible passages that you're talking about. But before we do, what were some of the other methods that these scientists used to arrive at their conclusions?
Well, the number one thing they did was, this was a British team of forensic scientists led by Dr. Richard Neave, formerly of the University of Manchester. But he teamed up with a team of Israeli archaeologists, and the Israeli archaeologists were able to lend him skeletal remains from several Semitic men from the time that Christ would have lived. And so with those remains, they were able to conduct all kinds of analyses and use the most sophisticated computer programs available to try to recreate what the muscle and other tissue would have been with those remains. So it all hinged pretty heavily on the fact that Christ would have looked like anyone at that time. And really what this study does, the head of it, Dr. Neave, is quick to say, this depiction is not Jesus Christ. This is what a typical man at the time would have looked like. And that's the best we can ever do.
Mm-hmm. So they found the typical man, but they're basically using him as the standard based on passages in the Bible that suggest that Jesus Christ didn't stand out from everybody else around him.
Yeah, that's exactly right. There's the passage in Matthew 26, 48 through 49 that talks about Judas, who was betraying Christ. He was working with the authorities at the time, and he had arranged beforehand, saying, I will walk up to Jesus Christ, I will identify him with a kiss. You know, I'll sort of embrace him, and I'll say, hello, master, and I'll give him a kiss. And so you guys will know that the person to whom I do that is Jesus. He's the one who you seek so that you can arrest him. And of course, that would have been unnecessary.
It would have been a whole lot easier if he would have been able to just say, hey, you want to arrest the tall guy with bright blue eyes and long flowing hair who doesn't look like anybody else.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's also a passage in Isaiah 53, verse 2, written long before Christ was born, you know, as a human, of course. But it says that it prophesied that he would have no exceptional beauty. It says, he has no form nor comeliness. When we shall see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. So, now,
was that actually a passage that these forensic scientists looked at? Or?
You know, I didn't see that one. They mostly just stuck to the New Testament.
Yep.
So they stuck to the one there in Matthew 26. But really, it just shows that the Old and New Testaments do agree on the fact that Christ would have had no exceptional beauty. He would have looked very much like the typical person at that time.
Well, it's extremely valid. If you just follow the New Testament account of Jesus Christ, you follow through the Gospels, and particularly the Gospel of Matthew, it's loaded with references to prophecies, including the one in Isaiah, that showed that he fulfilled to the letter each of these Old Testament prophecies that spoke of his first coming. So for that explicit mention of, you know, what he would have looked like, he certainly would have fulfilled that prophecy among all of those others.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. So in many ways, I think this study is valuable, not because it gives us a definite picture of what Christ looked like. That really doesn't even matter, and it's probably impossible. But it's valuable because it does disprove, and it really debunks this fallacy that is upheld by the world of Christianity so ubiquitously, that he had this certain appearance, that you know, all of the paintings and whatnot project him as having had. And also because it really does show, as you said, that those prophecies of the Old Testament were very much fulfilled in the New Testament by every detail of Christ's ministry and appearance. One other really significant aspect of this study, I think, is just the point about Christ's hair. You know, all of those depictions show the long flowy hair that you mentioned there. And if you look at the actual scriptures in the Bible, they don't say anything about Christ in particular, the length of his hair. But if you look at the writings of the Apostle Paul, Paul mentions having seen Jesus, and then later he describes long hair on a man as disgraceful. So you have to, you know, if you put that together, you have to ask, would Paul have written, if a man has long hair, it is a disgrace to him, if Jesus Christ, who he devoted his life to teaching, you know, teaching about and teaching about the teachings of. It's just really interesting, and Dr. Neave did rely on that passage of the New Testament as well, just to say Christ would not have had long hair, in addition to the fact that the typical Semitic man at the time didn't have long hair. This passage just further really proves that.
You know, in our publications, we really stay away from depictions of Jesus Christ. That's always been our policy. We look at basically, the second commandment says, you shall not make unto you any graven image, and take that as a command that really God doesn't want himself depicted. We could have pictures. Obviously, if you go to the Louvre, if you go to the Vatican museums or any major art gallery or art museum around the world, it's packed with pictures of Jesus Christ, pictures of God. And we stay away from those just because it seems clear from the second commandment that God doesn't want pictures of him. He doesn't want an artist trying to kind of capture or imagine what he looked like and then paint it or sculpt it and then have that image in the minds of people. I mean, that's exactly what has happened here. And to me, this is a really good illustration of why God wouldn't want that, because here you have this idea in a lot of people's minds of what Christ supposedly looks like that is just wrong. And it's coloring their perceptions of God in a way that he would not like.
Yes. Yeah. On top of those commands to avoid idolatry, there is a command that says we should worship God in spirit and in truth. And so a study like this comes out and reveals that those idols, all of those paintings and depictions, are done in the absence of truth. They're built on man-made traditions. And so it just really reveals that all those crucifixes, pictures, statues, and everything of Jesus Christ, they fail miserably to represent him as he was. And also, even in the attempt, that's a dangerous thing to even try to attempt to do, and a destructive thing to attempt.
Well, it's very interesting. We're talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques, and he's working on an article about this subject called What Did Jesus Really Look Like? You can watch for that in the coming days online at thetrumpet.com. Thanks for bringing this to our attention, Jeremiah.
Thanks for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
Have you had a discouraging setback recently? You work really hard on that presentation at work and the plan is rejected. That home improvement project that seemed simple turns out to be tricky, time-consuming, and a lot more expensive than you thought. You strive to meet a challenging goal and you fall short of attaining it. Well, what do you do when you smack face first into failure? Do you get negative and bitter? Do you allow discouragement to overwhelm you? Do you give up? A whole lot of people do. Letdowns happen to us all, and how we respond is what's really important. I recently encountered this old poem that speaks to the need to keep life's struggles, obstacles, and failures in perspective. "'Tis a lesson you should heed, try, try again. If at first you don't succeed, try, try again. Then your courage should appear, for if you will persevere, you will conquer. Never fear. Try, try again. Once or twice, though you should fail, try, try again. If you would at last prevail, try, try again. If we strive, 'tis no disgrace, though we do not win the race. What should you do in that case? Try, try again. If you find your task is hard, try, try again. Time will bring you your reward. Try, try again. All that other folks can do, why with patience should not you? Only keep this rule in view. Try, try again." Why try again when it's so much easier to sigh again or cry again and just give up? The reason is that failure is part of learning. Nobody is an instant expert. If you're pushing yourself, if you're doing hard things and learning and growing, you're going to fail. If something is really worth doing, it's going to take time and effort and failure to learn it. If you only do what comes easy to you and what you're already good at, you're going to be stuck in mediocrity. If when you fail, you give up, you'll never grow. That was true when you were learning to talk. It's also true as you're learning to deliver a speech. Wendell Phillips said, "What is defeat? Nothing but education. Nothing but the first steps to something better." There's something magnificent about watching a baby first learning to walk. This tiny human is amusingly awkward, on the edge of disaster at all times, repeatedly falling on his diaper-padded tushy, and yet he's happy wide-eyed, exhilarated, acting like these unsteady steps are spiking his adrenaline like the final strides up the peak of Everest. Now imagine the baby who fails time and time again, trying to walk, and finally gives up in exasperation. And now he's 45 years old, still crawling on his hands and knees. Yeah, I tried walking. It's not my thing. I've got no talent. That would obviously be pretty awkward. Herbert W. Armstrong wrote a booklet called The 7 Laws of Success. We'd be happy to send you a free copy. It's a great little booklet. The 6th of these 7 laws is perseverance. This booklet says 9 in 10, at least once or twice in a lifetime, come to the place where they appear to be totally defeated. All is lost, apparently, that is. They give up and quit. When just a little more determined hanging on, just a little more faith and perseverance, just a little more stick-to-itiveness would have turned apparent certain failure into glorious success. Learning to gracefully handle disappointment and to bounce back from failure, that's going to make you a lot more successful at a lot more things in your life. The person who remains positive, learns from his mistakes, applies the lessons of a failure, and charges forward for another attempt, that's the person who ultimately nails it. Proverbs 24, verse 16 is a wonderful proverb to remember. It says, "For a just man falls 7 times and rises up again, but the wicked shall fall into mischief." Everybody falls. But when the wicked fall, they don't get back up. When the righteous fall, they refuse to give up. They rise to their feet and keep moving forward. It says they fall 7 times and rises up again. 7 times is an expression that means over and over, again and again. Psalm 145 and verse 14 gives another scriptural promise to keep in mind. It says the Eternal upholds all that fall and raises up all that be bowed down. When you fall, God will revive you. When you're discouraged, He will pick you up and encourage you, just like a parent who is excitedly helping his toddler learn how to walk. So, you failed. Don't be discouraged by the fact that you're human like the rest of us. Think it through, get counsel, learn what you can from the mistake. Rise up, lift your chin, and move forward. The harder you work for something, the sweeter it'll be when you achieve it. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. This program is the voice of the Trumpet magazine. You can find us online at thetrumpet.com. That's where to find the stories that we talk about on this program. You can also go there to get a free subscription to this monthly news magazine, the Philadelphia Trumpet. We'd like to hear from you. Send us any comments or questions by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Richard Palmer, Robert Morley, and Jeremiah Jacques. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondeau. And I'll leave you with this thought from Elbert Hubbard. The greatest mistake you can make in life is continually fearing that you'll make one. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.